Folks, a quick message from our sponsors, KnowBefore. So what's a con game? It's a fraud that works by getting the victim to misplace their confidence in the con artist. In the world of cybersecurity, we call confidence tricks social engineering. And as our sponsors, KnowBefore, will tell you, human error is how most organizations are compromised. What are some of the ways organizations are victimized by social engineering? We'll find out here in just a minute. Now, our sponsors' questions about forms of social engineering come in this form. KnowBefore will tell you that there's human contact, there can be con games. It's important to build the kind of security culture in which your employees are enabled to make smart security decisions. To do that, they need a new school security awareness training. See how security culture stacks up against KnowBefore's free phishing test. Get it now at KnowBefore.com/phishing test. That's KnowBefore.com/phishing test. Now, KnowBefore wants to thank you for listening to the show, and I want to thank them for sponsoring it. They are the provider of the world's largest security awareness and simulated phishing platform. Be sure to take advantage of their free phishing test, which you can find at KnowBefore.com/phishing test. Thank KnowBefore for your security training.
From the Cyber Hub bunker in studio, you're listening to the CISO Talk Podcast. No sales, no bullshit, just straight talk.
Straight talk.
And now for your host and CISO, James Azar.
Sam, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, James, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it. These are always fun. I love doing these kinds of things.
Me too. So Sam is the head of information security architecture over at the Great Bank of Wells Fargo. I appreciate you taking time to join us today. I'm very grateful for it.
Oh, my pleasure. And I really love doing these things, and I always learn a lot. Hopefully I'll learn quite a bit more today.
I'm hoping that people learn more from you us from them today. But we've got a very exciting event coming up on April 27th. A good part of this podcast will be available exclusively on the ATP cyberfintech.com event page. So for those that want to go there and tune in, they can. But Sam, so kind of as we get started, could you just share with our listeners and our audience, people who are watching us and people who are listening, how'd you get started in cyber? What was your journey like?
Initially, it was sort of like a side event. So I was working at the Boeing company some years back, and we'll kind of leave the timeline out. But so I was working at Boeing, and I worked in the commercial airplane group at that point in time. That's what they called the commercial airplane side of the world. And the company was trying to start building out a security practice internal to Boeing. So ensuring that all the various divisions and organizations within Boeing had a focused security program. So I got nominated to join and become the first real manager of the cyber, or well, actually what at that point in time was just the security information security team within commercial. And we were in the architecture organization and commercial. So from there, it kind of grew, worked with several people within the overall program and the corporate teams. And we started to really build out a security program there. And so we added in things, such as first thing you get started off with is things like access controls. And we started talking about network security and then platform security and then some of the things that we needed to start doing there. And really, like I say, built out an overarching program for the whole of Boeing with a distinct focus in on each one of the various lines of business. So at that point in time, it was defense and space. We had commercial. There was Boeing's shared services and several other organizations. So again, like I say, what our focus was really just, what do we need to do? How do we build it out? And then I started putting together resources from the various divisions within commercial airplane to really provide that focus. So that was really sort of the start for me. From there, we really started building out a bigger piece of the infrastructure and started getting more deeply engaged in external activities so that we had a better view as to what was going on within the industry, as well as within the security side of the world. So that was sort of the start.
I love the start of InfoSec where it's just someone raised their hands and they were just like, hey, we need someone to do security. Anyone? And you're just kind of like, I'll do it. Not exactly. Knowing what you're really signing up for.
Well, that was kind of it. Is like, you know, my job to that point really wasn't information security. I mean, we talked about things like access control. We talked about, you know, profiles and things along those lines. At that point in time, we didn't really call them profiles, but, you know, it was access profiles that you could assign to people. And it really wasn't a well-defined area at that juncture. And so it was sort of like, okay, yeah, we need to do that. And then we need to, you know, restrict what people had access to that they didn't. And then also allow, make sure that people did have access. And at that juncture, the networks, I mean, we were still having the debate between what the baseline of the network was going to be. You know, was it going to be TCP? Was it going to be some other protocol? And so so there was a lot of, you know, SNA was like it. And so SNA was not exactly what you would call one of those things that was very flexible. I mean, you were really talking to the mainframes and the mainframe infrastructure. So we started building it out. That was great. I think, you know, our word processing tool was something that somebody had built, and you could put up to 65,000 bytes in it, which we thought was fantastic. I mean, who would write anything with more than 65,000 bytes in it? And, you know, very soon we found out they didn't last very long. And so, you know, then you had to start looking at commercial tools. And so, you know, things like Word started coming around, and so Lotus 1-2-3 and some of these other applications. And so we started, you know, looking at things along those lines. We worked very closely with our friends at Microsoft and others to really start to drive security built into their products. So we did, you know, some really interesting things there.
You know, I love the idea of information security architecture. As a CISO, I think there's a, you know, having a good team is critical, and we'll get to that later. I don't want to get to the geeky part 6 minutes into the episode. That's no fun. You know, I gotta get listening and viewing time up here. So we're gonna have people hang on for just a minute before we get into InfoSec architecture. Talk a little bit about you know, team building and kind of the skills you look for people who are trying to start a career in information security architecture. What are some of the key skills you look for when you're building your team?
A large part of it is really, you know, obviously you want to look for people with background and at least some level of information security. And typically with architecture, you want them to have had experience, practical experience within the information security arena. So engineers and, you know, things along those lines, people that have been really, you know, practicing or working on it. A lot of times we'll have people that have been developing, you know, like networks and building out networks. And they take a liking to security. And so, you know, you look at their skill set and the things that they've done, how they've done that. And then the next piece of that is, can they walk and talk and chew gum at the same time? So in other words, you know, can they talk with the people at the, you know, the real detail level, or at least a reasonably level of detail? And can they also talk to an executive and explain it without getting into a ton of detail? The execs typically don't really have the background to really participate in those sessions. So you've got to be very crisp and clean and very brief and to the point to help them. So it's a challenge. You want people with a lot of technical skill and a lot of technical background, but you also want them to have the social skills to be able to have a conversation with different levels of management, as well as different levels, even within the engineering and operations teams. So, you know, you got to have that background, but you also have to be able to walk and talk and chew gum at the same time.
You know, it's very, very fascinating as we look at kind of the workforce. I don't want to say shortage, but part of the challenge of the workforce is we have, I think, 80 people apply for an entry-level role, but then that mid-range role, we may get 4 or 5 people that apply for it simply because of the expectations or the qualifications that are required make it very, very difficult. Do you find like one specific background tends to give people more of an edge in some cases, or is it more of the desire or ability to learn that stand out to you more?
My practical experience really is around the desire and the ability to learn. I think having both interpersonal communication skills, being somewhat forthcoming, really are tools that you really need in this particular job, because you've got to work with a lot of different people. We really look for people with a fairly broad background, although they need to have some level of expertise in an area. And let's pick, like, for example, network security or cloud security or something along those lines. because you're going to look for skill set to help you grow in that area. And you want people with that background and that common understanding to help really drive the right approach. And so, you know, we spend quite a bit of time looking at, you know, at folks with a broad level of skills, the ability, and I think, you know, again, communication, interpersonal skills are really critical. We've got several people that have, you know, they're very, you know, almost introverted, but they also are very good at expressing themselves. And, you know, the introvert gives them the good focus that you need to really build out your architecture and build out the detail behind it to help drive the, you know, the approach that you're looking for. But they also need to be able to, again, like I say, explain it and communicate with everybody, not just folks in the technology organization. It's very hard to find. We find a lot of people with, you know, great skills, but, you know, they're missing something. And a lot of times it's just their ability to communicate well with others.
What's the easiest skill to teach, the technical or the social part?
I think the technical. And, you know, and some of that also depends upon their approach to life or, you know, where they're comfortable. Some people are really comfortable being technical, and you can teach them a little bit about the, you know, the skill set that's required to do that communication. But I think typically if they come in and they've got good communication skills and they have some technical background, it's a little bit easier to help drive that direction. Like I say, with architecture, though, you want somebody that has deep practical knowledge, but now is willing to go up a level. And when I say go up a level, this is not quite, you know, dabble in so much of the detail, but to be able to put the pieces of the puzzle together and then explain it. So again, that you know, that's really what we look for. I usually look for somebody that's got that technical background and that experience and then can walk and talk and chew gum at the same time.
I love it. Walk, talk, chew gum at the same time. I think that's, you know, it sounds easier said than done in a lot of cases, especially around InfoSec. Which kind of brings up something very important that you talked about, which is being able to speak to the business unit in a way where you're not confusing them with information, you're not getting overly technical. And in a lot of cases, we earn our roles because of our technical abilities, not necessarily because of our social abilities, because when people think of InfoSec, they want, you know, I like to call it a few years ago, a recruiter reached out to me and had me set up to speak to some company. We're looking to hire a CISO. And they were like, yeah, we're kind of looking for the hacker in the hooded shirt to lead our security program. And I was like, I think you have a misconception of what a CISO should be, but okay, I'll entertain this conversation just a little bit more than that. When you talk to business and you're kind of trying to simplify something as complex as architecture, what are some of your best practices and what are some of the ways you really are able to deliver something, you know, simply to folks in the business?
I think a lot of it really depends upon where we are in a development lifecycle or in a build out of, you know, an infrastructure or a service. Let's say, for example, like cloud. I think a lot of it is that if we just move everything to, you know, pick a cloud provider, we just turn it on and everything goes. And it's like, it's not that simple. You know, you have to take everything into consideration that you are doing internally and then saying, how can I do that in the cloud infrastructure? Now, you may not be providing that service, you know, to yourself or buying a specific solution, but you're certainly going to be dependent upon what they're doing and what you also want to bring to the table as you see, you know, it's going to be easier for me to run or easy to manage. So I think a large part of that is really just trying to figure out how all the pieces are going to come in together and then being able to, you know, move that communication stack back and forth. And so, you know, I look for people that really are going to be able to explain the high level goal. So in other words, set the goal. And then drive down into what are the components that you need to put into place, and then how do all those pieces come together to provide you with the robust security model that you're looking for. The other thing that I think people you typically run into this, especially on a technical side, is I can do this. I can do this doesn't necessarily translate into, is it something that I really need in order to deliver the service and to make sure that I've got adequate security or reasonable enough security to make the products or the solutions work? And I think that's part of the challenge is that you get technical people that want to do the absolute everything you must, and you, which is good, but everything else that are not necessarily required in order to deliver that solution. So I mean, that's part of the challenge is what do you really need versus I can bring all this stuff in. Well, great. But is it really going to add to the overarching security? And is it going to drive me to the point where I can actually do what I want to do? And it's going to cost me so much, I'll never be able to make it, you know, financially viable.
Yeah, that's a very interesting conversation to have with business stakeholders, right? Because, you know, one of the common themes in a lot of, you know, security circles when we're in our roundtables is we don't get enough budget, we don't get enough support. And I sometimes reverse that challenge back and I say, what are you not communicating to the business where they're not giving you what you need to do your job? Because
that's also your communication side, right?
Right. I mean, there's a big thing for us about communication where, you know, we need to be straightforward. We need to keep it simple. We need to explain the risk. We need to explain how we can mitigate the risk. We need to explain the overarching costs. And we need to be able to present it to the business in a way where, you know, we're leading them to the decision to nod and sign off on the budget request so that we can get our jobs done. And when I hear a lot of these conversations over, you know, we don't get enough money, it mind boggles me as to why are we failing in communicating the urgency of cyber so much?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of it is also that, well, that'll never happen to me. Well, how do you know? I mean, if you don't put the controls in place, you're really going to keep yourself open. There's also the risk discussion, because this isn't nothing we do is zero risk. So it's what's your risk tolerance, what you as a business willing to put up with, and that will help define what the controls are and how much it's going to cost to, you know, to build and operate. And I think there's a balance in there, which we really don't teach people very well, which is that risk reward trade-off, and especially around doing a risk assessment and risk analysis, and then having everybody understand what that means. I think, you know, because we'll walk in and we'll go, you know, here are the risks and here are the things that are going to happen. And without actually telling them what the downside is of avoiding these particular risks, because there's a cost associated with mitigation, then, you know, they really don't have the information, the necessary information to make a business decision. And again, that's, you know, if you think about financial services, if we were zero risk, we would never lend money, right?
Right.
And so again, you know, the thing is that, so what's that risk reward trade-off? Where's that level at that the business is willing to accept the risk? And is there enough profit in what you're doing to be able to take that and then also to return the margins that you're looking for? So again, the same thing is security has to look at that and understand it. But we have to put those in terms that the business understands, not in technology terms or security terms. Otherwise, you know, you've lost the game and their eyes glaze over and they kind of like, you know, fall asleep for the rest of the discussion. So
you've kind of in your current role, but even in your previous roles, you've kind of transitioned. Have you, when you transition from company to company, you know, is learning terminology, the internal terminology of a company, very important for you?
Absolutely. You have to understand their language. And I'm not talking about, you know, English, French, Spanish. It's what's the terminology that they use? And you need to be able to understand that in order to be able to explain what you're doing and then explain the risk reward trade-offs to the business. You know, some areas it's a high risk item. I mean, you know, if you think about airplanes, that's a low risk item. You know, you build a lot of redundancy into your systems. Whereas if you've got a shovel, there's not a lot of, you know, the risk in there is just, you know, making sure you don't do something that it holds up as expected and that it doesn't fall apart. So I mean, there's you know, you've got to figure that model out and then adjust based upon what the business is that you're in, and then be able to explain what you're doing, how it contributes to the success of the product, and then do that risk reward trade-off.
Yeah, that risk reward trade-off is a challenge, I think, in a lot of places. You know, I often talk about your first, you know, 6 months in your role, right? And how you're learning for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you need to learn is what are the KPIs that the company actually cares about? And what's the language that they use in the business sense that's communicated down? So the best way to understand that, I always tell people, is go hang out with the people you probably never want to hang out with, the salespeople. And whatever the language the salespeople are talking, understand they represent the business in the way they communicate. So if you get that, you'll be able to translate that quickly into upstream and into the business more so than, let's say, for example, you know, hanging out with the IT team or the ops team.
No, I totally agree. And I think, you know, from the stuff that, and I like your approach, is hang out with the sales staff. Never really thought about that. That's actually a really good idea. Now, you know, in one of the positions that I've had, we did hang out and we were, you know, tightly aligned with the sales team. So you were listening to what they were saying and kind of going, oh boy, this is gonna be fun. But again, you learn a lot about about the product. You learn a lot about how it's being marketed and how things are being pushed forward. You also get to understand the value of security, you know, one way or the other in the overall project and the program. You know, I typically try to work with the business teams and so hang out with the business teams in the first, you know, 90 to 100 days, just to understand as much as I can about the business. You know, and you're not doing it 100% of the time, but you're attending, you know, meetings that your team has with your business partners. You're attending just, you know, general business partner meetings that you can get yourself into so that you really start to understand their language. You start to understand their risk tolerance. You start to understand what they're really trying to do and where they're trying to go. And I think that helps you really formulate your strategy moving forward as to how you want to organize your security program, as well as, you know, things like architecture, and the kind of resources that you're going to need to drive that event, or the right events, I should say.
Yeah, that's I love that. You know, let's talk a bit about security architecture here. You know, and a lot of people, you know, when they think of you know, InfoSec architecture, I think in their minds they think of just people who are probably strategizing. How true is that?
There's certainly a strategy approach, and I think a lot of that is that it depends upon what you're doing. And you know, from my perspective, is we work to get our teams integrated in with the business. So as the business is looking at the business strategy, we're understanding how we can drive, you know, technology, especially security technology strategy or security strategy, even if it's not technology driven, to support what the business wants to do. And again, you got to take into consideration the risk tolerance and, you know, that kind of stuff. But I think it's important to really, you know, where's the business want to go? What's the business's strategy? How are they doing it? And then what's the technology strategy? And then how can you influence that with the architecture that's going to drive the right result? And again, you know, what controls do you need to have in place? What solutions can you come up with that will drive that control? And then how does it all integrate in with where the business wants to go? And again, is that, you know, you need to look at all the corresponding components that support it and all the rest of it. But again, it's just really that high level focus saying, this is what you need to do in order to support where you want to go. And here's how you go about doing that.
Right. And that's really, really interesting. So Sam, we kind of look at, you know, the idea of, you know, cybersecurity, you know, architecture and some of the digital transformation that's going on right now. And it's a very exciting time in the fin services world and the fintech world. I mean, the way people buy, the ease of use and all these different payment technologies have really created almost a transformation. How does architecture adapt to all these transformations that are going on right now?
I think, you know, from my perspective, a lot of it is hanging out with innovation teams. And so, you know, getting an understanding as to what things they're looking at, what things they're thinking about, and how, you know, how do we think that's going to be driven into the business? And so, you know, we hang out with the innovation folks. We also hang out with and we try to really spend a lot of time with the businesses as they're setting their strategies for the year or their strategies for a product or a solution set so that we understand where they're headed. And the other thing that I think is that within technology, as well as within security and architecture, is what can you do to enable a feature of the business or to help drive that particular feature or that solution? So that's a large part of what we're really trying to do, is saying, how can we be an enabler? So think about mobile banking or something along those lines. What things can we do? Well, you know, if you've got a bunch of passwords and stuff like that, you know, potentially there'll be some problems with it. Are there ways that we can do a better job of it? And so along come things like biometrics. And once you're comfortable with the security of the biometric, ensuring that that kind of stuff is built in. So it just makes it much more seamless and much easier to use. Things like NFC payments, you know, a lot of the transactions like Apple Pay, Google Pay, Samsung Pay, things along those lines. I mean, those are results of, hey, I want to be able to do this with this device. So this device becomes me. Okay, how can we do that? Let's figure out what the architecture looks like. Let's look at the, you know, the technology that's coming down the path. When can you do this? And how do you make it simple and straightforward for people to use, yet provide the security in the background? So. And like I have fun with the innovation team. So right now, I mean, you know, my one of my pet projects that, you know, we've been working on is quantum safe encryption. And, you know, it's like, why do you care? Because quantum's not going to be here for, you know, 5, maybe 6 years down the road. Thing is that you got a lot of persistent data that has a lot of challenges associated with it. And, you know, if you can't protect that data now, I just hang on to it. If I'm, somebody that wants to do you harm, I just, you know, accumulate it. Quantum comes along, I unencrypt it. It's still, you know, still relevant. And then I'm off to the races. So again, it's just like, how can you do something and, you know, how can you avoid that particular piece of the equation? So we're really looking very closely at, you know, there are a lot of algorithms out there for doing it. The question is how do you implement them? What do you really want to implement? So there are a lot of questions, but I mean, we've got to answer those now. It's not something we can wait for. So that's kind of fun. Cause I mean, it's really interesting to talk to the physicists and to the folks that are really on the leading edge with cryptography.
Yeah, I had Chris Lindberg, who's the chief innovation officer over at the CDC. In December of 2019, I had him on the show, and we were talking about quantum when it comes to medical data.
Right.
To only have COVID break out a few short months later. But the idea of how quantum computing would help you recognize pandemics as they evolve at a much greater speed because the data sets no longer rely on traditional computing power, or the idea of how quantum really isn't a, you know, MacBook in your, you know, in your office. You know, a quantum computer is more of a, you know, the technology around quantum computing is very fascinating. I love the fact that you guys are thinking 5-6 years down the road, because I think quantum is going to be here much quicker than people actually think. Like, I think we're going to see first use cases of quantum within the next, you know, 18 to 24 months, mm-hmm. because it's a key competitive advantage for corporations, right? Google and IBM have both claimed quantum supremacy at one point or another over the last 12 months. We know that China is very much active on quantum computing. They see an advantage in getting it. And it's very interesting to see you talk about, you know, kind of looking at that problem now, because that shows the forward thinking that you have as a leader. And I think that's really important. I think that's really, really important. So tell me a little bit about, you know, as you're kind of evaluating all of these different and technologies that are coming through, what are some of the key technologies beyond quantum that you're looking at and you're kind of saying, you know, these could change the way we do things?
Well, I think if we start looking at, there's some overused terms, but I think it's the concepts behind them. But I, you know, things like edge computing and zero trust. I get it. We put these monikers around it, but and they help us really start to define the concepts around them. But I think as we start looking at that, how do we develop sort of like the zero trust approach, where I'm looking at the environment and then understanding what the risks are associated with it as I'm making decisions around access, around transactions and things along those lines. And I think that really is going to start to drive the model forward for providing much easier to use and much more seamless integration of security and into the solution set that the businesses are really looking for. Hopefully it will also help us simplify the infrastructure required to support a good security program and a very good security operation. So, I mean, that's a big chunk of it. And I think, you know, we look at things like edge computing, which is part of that equation. We look at how we can really do a better job of protecting the endpoints and the endpoint solutions as part of it as well. But it's really looking at that complete picture. How do we make this simple, yet secure, because the more complex you make it, you know, obviously the more opportunities there are for things to fail. So I think, you know, things like zero trust really start to come into play as we see the infrastructure, you know, being able to support additional components along those lines. That's probably one of the big pieces, like I say, you know, things along the lines of quantum, which we're looking for both how do we protect it using quantum, as well as you know, the potential risks associated with somebody not using quantum and being able to crack it with a quantum computer. So, you know, that's really, I mean, a large part of the approach that we keep looking at. I mean, we look at things like, you know, cryptography, we look at the network security layers, we look at, you know, in the past we used to use Bastion hosts. And you know, as we build out the infrastructure for providing online banking or mobile banking or something along those lines, but as we start moving down the path towards, you know, cloud, we start moving down the path towards, you know, the zero trust. Some of those paradigms change, and it's like, how do you morph those and then still support the business while it continues to grow?
So one of the common things that I think a lot of people say about, you know, InfoSec architecture is you're kind of the brainchild of security by design, right? Because at the end of the day, you don't build a building without an architect, right? And you don't design an InfoSec infrastructure without your architecture, without your architecture team. So how do you start to kind of approach security by design? What is your personal philosophy around it?
Well, I think, you know, security has to be built in. So you have to be a player at the beginning of a project. Or a program or a solution. And I think it's really working with and showing and demonstrating the value to the business and to the technology partnership to really get built into and to get engaged. I think the other side of this equation too, and there's several views on this, is, you know, by creating tool sets so that it's very much plug and play. And again, this gets back into things like, you know, zero trust and things along those lines, is so that, you know, you're just walking the door and you've got a pattern that's already predefined. You've got the tools that they plug in and that they can leverage and they can use. So again, you're simplifying how you drive security into the infrastructure, how you drive it into the applications and the services offering. But it's taking the viewpoint from the businesses. What is it they're trying to accommodate? Do I have the tool set? Can I make it simple and easy to use and then drive it forward?
Yeah, it's very fascinating, because when you kind of highlighted all these different methods to really create security by design, whether it be, you know, the zero trust model or others. When you consider how you know effectively speaking, zero trust itself is a 50-50 approach by a lot of security practitioners. I did a survey on LinkedIn a little while ago, and I said, zero trust, the buzzword or an actual security program? And it was a 50-50 split. It was unbelievable. So 50% of people said, hey, it's an actual, you know, security method. And 50% of the people said, it's a buzzword and it's on my spam filter. And if anyone ever sends me an email with zero trust, I don't ever see it. Why do you think zero trust has such a, such a bad rep with 50% of the people?
I'm one of those that, you know, I start hearing a buzzword and it's like, go away, you're bugging me. And again, it's just like, you know, it gets overused by the vendor, and all of a sudden, you know, they latch, you know, by the vendor community, but even by the security community and others, and they just latch onto it and they constantly are using it. What's important is to look at the constructs and the concepts behind it and say, okay. You know, and like I say, when I first started, you know, this conversation, and I mentioned, you know, zero trust is it becomes the buzzword of the day. It really is taking the concepts and understanding, you know, how do those concepts work, and what are the constructs around it that we can then drive the experience. And if we pick the buzzword, great. And again, like, you know, I'm sort of like, if I see an incoming email that has, you know, zero trust here today, I may or may not look at the vendor. And it just depends upon, you know, the mood that I'm in, whether I think they're really going to bring something to the table that I'm missing or have something new. And it's really a challenge, because I really hate the buzzwords. And you know, and again, that's the way that a lot of the stuff gets sold. So I think, you know, from the 50-50 perspective, you know, people that are looking at it from the concepts and what I want to do from a conceptual perspective, those are the 50 that are going to say, yeah, you know, we'll go with that. the folks that are looking at, I'm getting a bunch of junk mail from vendors, you know, stating that they can drive zero trust, then, you know, those are the folks that are going to go, you know, get away from me. And so I think, you know, again, it's the split between, you know, I've got an idea. Okay. So zero trust, I can live with that. And then the other side, which is, you know, you're using buzzwords, so I'm not going to trust what you're talking
about. Yeah. There's, I almost always look at these buzzwords and, wonder, you know, when will be the day. I have a buzzword graveyard. We'll get to that in just a little bit. Because I do have a buzzword graveyard, and there's a lot of buzzwords buried in my buzzword graveyard. It's massive at this point. I've dug way too many graves in the over 110 episodes I've done in CISA Talk, where, you know, we've buried buzzwords. So, you know, as we kind of look at not only innovation, but the business, the user innovation of how they use technology, right? Which plays a, you know, there's the business architecture, you know, of how the business envisions a user using something. And then, as you and I both know, there comes the user and uses it in a completely different way than what anyone in the business thought the user would be using it for. How do you adjust for some of the those from a technology perspective?
And part of it is really understanding what the business is trying to do and trying to understand the alignment, and then being able to, you know, rationalize between the buzzwords, rationalize between the vision, and then the ability to implement or to drive that vision. What is it that they really want to do? And then try to figure that out and you know, understand their definitions, because that will help you with that understanding as to where do they really want to go and what is it that they're really trying to drive. So once you started getting that down, it's you know, replaying things back and making sure that you understand and that they understand what you're talking about and that you get that alignment. And I think too many times, you know, we'll say, oh, well, we'll go off and we'll build this for you. And then we go off and we build it, and it wasn't exactly what they really wanted. And this gets back into the, you know, too much detail and too much technology versus, you know, this is what this is going to bring to the equation. And this is what it's going to do for you. This is what it's going to do for your customers and for your business partners. And I think that's really part of the challenge, is being able to do that explanation and build the rationalization for how this is going to support them.
So I kind of want to pick your expertise on something for a moment. One of the critical changes that we've seen over the last 12 months, partly due to COVID, has been that rapid move to the cloud environment, kind of from on-prem. And that creates a significant architecture challenge, simply because, you know, if you're doing a multi-cloud environment, it creates a bunch of level of complexities. And as you and I both know, the more APIs or the more the things that connect to other pieces, the more ways things can break down. So, you know, from your experience kind of looking at that, without giving information that really puts anything out there, how do you see the digital transformation from an architecture perspective, from the on-prem to the cloud movement? And what are some of the challenges you're seeing that maybe are going to, you know, kind of be the Achilles heel over the next, you know, 12 to 18 months?
I think part of it is the maturity of the cloud product offerings or cloud service offerings that the cloud providers bring to the table. And again, I think that, you know, over the lifespan of cloud so far, I mean, there's been a huge growth and a huge change. And I think a lot of it is because, you know, we continue to push and say, look, we need to be able to do this in the cloud. You know, we do something similar and lay out the constructs or the, you know, the concepts, and be able to push and work with the vendors to provide those particular set of tools and services. And I think part of the challenges right now is you want to just take and you want to do a lift and shift. Here's my infrastructure. I'm just going to put it in a hosted environment on a cloud. And then I'm going to assume or expect that all of the controls that I've built and all the tools that I'm leveraging are going to be the same. So it's really understanding what aligns with what you want to do. How are you going to be able to manage that in addition to what you've got going on in your internal infrastructure? And then, do I have adequate controls around those? And then another piece of that is, who's done the validation of the infrastructure that they have built out and the controls that they have built out to meet the requirements that you're laying on the table? You know, you can do that, but is there a third party that you can go to and say, look, you know, do you have some sort of third party assessment that says, yeah, they agree? And so, you know, that's really a large chunk of what we try to do is understand, you know, what are the concepts, what are the constructs that we need in that environment? How do they provide them? What do we have to bring to the table? And then for the things that they're providing, who's gone through and who's taken a look at them and done the validation that they work? And then once you've done the validation, is like, how do I implement it to hit that control surface that I'm looking for?
Yeah, that's a wonderful kind of approach to it, because it's one of the common kind of things I see with, you know, threat hunting teams and security researchers as we kind of turn our eyes towards the cloud is the challenges of really properly configuring the cloud and building the right architecture. Because so often people just start to build without really thinking. Like you said, I think something that really resonates with me from our conversation thus far is, hey, we're thinking of quantum. And yeah, it could be 5-6 years away or not, but we're already thinking about it and we're looking at it and we're trying to build algorithms that help us, you know, defend from this technology now, because we don't want to be behind the eight ball. And I think that's that shows just the level of thought leadership and security awareness that really kind of derives that really kind of sets apart what I like to call like the security leaders from the security practitioners, right? Which is, I'm putting out fires all the time. I'm not really thinking ahead to, you know, I'm planning 5 years ahead. Is what I'm doing now going to be adequate 5 years down the road? Mm-hmm. And that's not often the case right now with the cloud transformation, right? It's a lot of people are just moving to the cloud so fast that they're forgetting, you know, key aspects of their architecture that are going to really leave them vulnerable. And so, you know, when you evaluate risk from third parties, let's say, do you think that architecture should play part of the vendor risk management process?
I think the architecture should be engaged in understanding the risk constructs associated with a particular vendor, and certainly understanding, you know, so what's the risk items that we're walking into, because you're going to have to figure out how to address those risk items if it's a vendor that you absolutely have to have because of some sort of business need. And then, you know, being able to explain in risk terminology that you're not going to be able to do this or this because the technology is lacking in that space, or you can't implement or something like that, and allow the business to make those decisions with support from you. So I think, you know, having architecture up front so we can understand what is it that we can do. Can we do the compensating, mitigating controls? Or is it something that right now it doesn't exist, or it's going to be extremely hard to do and you probably aren't going to be able to for a while? And then work with the business to make a decision and your risk partners, whoever those happen to be, to really get that understanding. And I think that's, you know, that's a critical part of this. One of the things that I just want to really kind of bring this up, sort of a little bit of a sidetrack though, is that it's not just the technology that you've got, it's also the configuration. So if you think about it, there are certain companies that have taken a lot of heat because something's happened in their environment and it's been a configuration issue on the customer's behalf. And while we've been pushing those particular vendors to really, you know, put the tools in place and also the services in place to alert their customers to problems, potential problems, and to help them figure out how to get those addressed. And I think that fits into this kind of a model as well.
Yeah, that's a brilliant point, which is most of the time, a traditional, I want to say, the ideal way of doing something isn't always ideal, right? As a CISO, I'll tell you that oftentimes when we do our stand-up sessions and we're talking about a challenge we have, I've trained my entire staff now to think of it this way. What do we have in place that could be configured a little differently to help address this problem? Mm-hmm. Right? Because a lot of times you can solve problems by just configuring an existing tool or an existing control that's in place to address it.
Right.
And sometimes you don't have that. But the maturity is critical in an organization, right? And that maturity of being able to go and look at configuration, and you nailed it on the head. It's the identify and protect aspect. And people are so worried about detection and respond and remediate that they're forgetting to identify and protect. Identify and protect. Those are the two key aspects of anything. And I see so many people focused on detect, respond, remediate. And not enough people on the identify and protect. And I like that thought process. And I always try to tell people, how do we identify better? How do we protect what we identify?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, totally agree. And I think, again, a lot of it comes down to, you know, the detect, respond, recover is when you've run into a problem that you haven't anticipated. So the more things that you anticipate and you put upfront control structures in place or tools in place to mitigate those, the less you have to depend upon those recovery aspects. And so I think, you know, that's an important piece that I think a lot of it we forget. And again, as you know, you're looking at, you know, risk reward trade-offs. It's like, what happens if this, you know, fails, or if I've got a problem with it, then I've got to go through a recovery exercise. And, you know, that's firefighting mode for all intents and purposes. And you can do a really good job of being a firefighter, but if you don't have a fire up front, you don't have to, you know, go through that exercise, which is going to be disruptive. You can put more resources on building where you want to go and ensuring that you've got the hardened infrastructure and the components that you need in order to, you know, meet your risk appetite. But again, you know, you're still going to need the detect, respond, recover side of the equation, the firefighting side, because you're not going to catch everything. And, you know, stuff will change. And then you're also going to discover that, you know, there are certain failures in some of the things that you've picked or selected. And so you got to be able to deal with those as well.
No, I agree. I definitely agree. I'm not saying, but I feel like with a lot of the conversations I've had, at least, you know, with our vendors, right? When we talk about vendor risk management, which I think is a very, very important piece, because, you know, what we've witnessed over the last 4 or 5 months has been the software supply chain's been completely exposed for what it is. Mm-hmm. It's creating significant challenges for a lot of security practitioners. And something I've been doing as a CISO, and I talk about it a lot on the show, is when we bring on vendors, I ask for the entire software toolkit. I want to know the nutritional facts of the software you're using. And I want to know what critical pieces of it. I'll sign any contract you send our way in terms of secrecy and NDA and non-disclosure. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, hosted in your own environment, give me, you know, access to it so that we can see it when we need to. But we have to keep now a software supply chain list so that every vulnerability that pops that may not be our software, but could be one of our critical vendors, you know, our vendor team, our vendor risk management team is reaching out to that vendor and going, hey, you know, Chuck, are you guys patching, you know, this challenge we have with PHP right now, this vulnerability? And if not, what are your plans so that we can also, from our end, start to change our configurations? Again, going back to your configuration piece, I think that's one of the smartest things I've heard in a very long time on the show, which is, how do we change that configuration piece so that we're not part of this vulnerability, right? Because that changes your risk, and your risk changes almost by the second, by the app, by the minute, and by the day. Your risk is never stays, you know, complacent. Your risk never stays the same.
Exactly. And again, I totally agree. I think that, you know, the challenge is that you've got all the threat actors out there, and they're not just sitting around, you know, waiting for stuff to happen. They're out there actively looking.
Right.
And they're really aggressive on trying to find those things that are going to cause you problems or going to allow them to do, you know, whatever it is that they want to do. And so things like configuration and certainly, you know, DAST and SAST testing, things along those lines, where you're really going out there and then, you know, hammering it for those things in a critical space are there. And you also have to, and I think this is one of the things that, you know, I run into, not necessarily where I'm at now, but in other places, where they really haven't gone through and made the decisions around what's critical and what's not. And then then you do some level of segmentation of some kind so that the non-critical environments can't pollute your critical world and cause problems over there. So I think that, you know, there's clearly understanding that if you're going to, you know, treat things differently, how do you provide that level of segmentation, you know, or fire breaks or whatever you want to call it, to minimize the potential risk that, you know, a less secure environment causes to your more secure environments. And so, you know, same thing we use with, you know, the whole firewall complex on internet facing infrastructure or third party facing infrastructure. As you know, you create the DMZ pieces and you put a lot of controls in place in there, and then you, you know, really build out and support it. So, you know, some things to think about.
Love it. So we're at the tail end of our fireside chat here. To everyone watching us on the ATP Cyber FinTech, I hope you've enjoyed this session. I've got a few fun questions for Sam to end today's session that are going to be a blast. So remember how we were talking about my buzzword graveyard?
Mm-hmm.
What buzzword would you bury in my graveyard, Sam?
Yeah, there's so many of them. I mean, this is a target-rich environment, right?
Well, yeah, I know, but you get to pick one. That's the beauty of it. Just one buzzword that people know to never email Sam with ever again.
Well, I'm starting to head towards zero trust. And I hate to say it because, you know, the concept is great, but it's just like everybody's using it now. Every piece of email I get has, you know, zero trust buried in it somewhere. You know, that's certainly one of them. Cloud security, we used to always, you know, kid was an oxymoron, but quite honestly, I think, you know, they've grown. And so I think our capabilities are there, but I'm kind of tending to lean towards zero trust.
I love it. We talked a little bit about this, but what's one tech you see really changing the way we do cybersecurity?
Wow. That's a really good question. I think there's so many things that are going on now. And I think a lot of it is, you know, you see new stuff every day. I think artificial intelligence and again, this is tuned artificial intelligence, should really help us do a better job of understanding the threat horizon as it's building, because, you know, there are leading indicators and it's very difficult because of all the noise out there to figure out and understand those leading indicators that are going to drive you down a path of saying, okay, I see this thing, I see this threat potentially growing. And then you can start to build your control surfaces to minimize the potential impact for that. And AI is another buzzword that I think everybody's, you know, really coming up with. But, you know, the fundamentals behind it are really there. I think a lot of this is being able to do that and to build that out and make it happen.
I agree. True AI is definitely something. And we're almost out of time, so I won't go into my AI rant. People on the show have heard it like way too many times. And I've got some really funny stories of how, you know, I've been on a pitch with a vendor, and the, you know, the sales guy thinks he's, you know, super smart, he or she, and they're like, yeah, and we use AI. And I was like, so tell me how your AI works. Well, you know, we study your, and I'm like, that's machine learning. No, it's AI. And I'm like, no, that's machine learning. That's literally the definition of machine learning. Let me share my screen and let me show you my Wikipedia. Let me show you the Wikipedia definition of machine learning. Let me show you the Wikipedia definition of AI. But nonetheless, we won't get into that. What's the book you're reading at the moment?
I'm actually going back and rereading The Phoenix Project.
Uh-huh.
And again, the reason I'm doing that is that, you know, you get so tied up in other things. And this one is that as we start moving more aggressively into another one of my favorite buzzwords, as you start really looking at this whole model, it's like, you know, you really need to think about where you've been, what you need to focus in on, and how you need to drive it. And so, you know, again, as I mentioned, firefighting, well, that's the fourth item that you know, if you read through the Phoenix Project, you know, really looking at the alignment. So where's the best value for the company? It's in, you know, in the first item, which is, you know, you're building new components and new services. Where your value add starts to drop is at the back end when you're playing firefighter. And so again, it's just really just, you know, it's helping me just kind of take that view again and kind of help people understand, you know, how do we drive where the value add is and how do we push this forward as opposed to, you know, I want to build something that's going to provide value to the company as opposed to playing firefighter all the time because what we built before doesn't work. So
yeah, absolutely. What's the last movie you saw?
So the last movie I saw, you know, we watch a lot of movies, but the last, what I would say, you know, for release on the quote big screen unquote was Wonder Woman 1984. That was actually kind of interesting. It probably wasn't my favorite coming out of there, but it was actually a lot of fun. We'll see.
Love it. Do you have a favorite music you listen to?
I like a lot of variety. I grew up in the Western U.S., so, you know, you listen to some country Western and stuff like that. I like jazz. I hate to say it, but rock and roll. You know, some of the old classical rock and roll stuff. So, you know, that kind of stuff. Yeah,
dude, that's my road trip playlist. Whenever I drive up to Charlotte, it's just good old rock and roll, man. You can't listen to anything else.
I'm with you. Exactly. So I've got a pretty extensive rock and roll playlist.
Brilliant. Sam, thanks so much for joining us on the CISO Talk podcast and at the ATP Cyber FinTech 2021 event that has just been, it's a fun thing to do our first hybrid event of 2021 and kind of get back to some level of normal. I hope to see you during Cyber Week, Georgia Cyber Week, I'm sorry, but in September, it'll be a blast, but thank you so much for coming on and taking time to share with us today.
And James, thank you. It's been great to meet you. I look forward to catching up again. And, you know, both of those events, I'm looking forward to it. I like it because it's a lot of fun. And I think, you know, this will be great. So it's been great to meet you. And this has been a lot of fun. So I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Folks, don't forget to rate this session as you're walking away from it. And you can submit questions and we'll try to answer them at a later date if you have them. I know that this is pre-recorded, but I'll be watching this session. So as you ask your questions in the comment section, I'll be responding myself. And if Sam is available on the day and he's able to join us for a little bit, he'll also be there to kind of answer some of the questions or comments you guys have. But Sam Phillips, folks, head of information security architecture over at the Great Bank of Wells Fargo. My name is James Azar, folks. Another virtual session coming up here in just a few moments on the ATP Cyber FinTech event. Until then, folks, thank you so much and enjoy the rest of the event.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, James.
Cheers.
Make sure to subscribe to our podcast and share it with your friends and colleagues. And get all the latest information at cyberhubpodcast.com.